Hi, you're listening to Secrets for an Inspirational Life with me, your host, Mimi Novick. I'm so happy and thrilled to have you here with me. I have created this series for all of us so we can change our world together and live a more holistic and balanced life. Together, we will share lots of inspiring stories from all walks of life, speak with leading experts, enjoy healthy living ideas, explore music and subjects that inspire each other to always have hope. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate all of you. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Secrets for an Inspirational Life. How are you all today? I hope that everybody is finding a little contentment, a little adventure, and hopefully a lot of peace in these ever-changing times. And one of the most important things, I think, in life for all of us, whether we sometimes forget or sometimes don't remember as often as we should, is that primarily peace is that gives us the peaceful soul, peaceful heart, and the ability to navigate through this world. Sometimes, although it is difficult and can seem overwhelming, no matter what happens to us in our life, as long as there is life, there is hope. And what has happened, we must leave behind us and live in the ever-present now. Now, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome my guest tonight, who is the very interesting Hannah Studley. And she is all the way in Jerusalem. Yes, I was very excited about that, I have to say. Hannah is a mind, body, and wellness coach. She worked in Hollywood for 20 years, creating special effects in major movies, and gained an Academy Award as part of the team for the movie Babe. During the 1980s, after three very violent attacks, Hannah suffered severe PTSD, experiencing years of debilitating anxiety and stress. But following a somewhat miraculous transformation, she trained to be a coach and a counsellor and has spent the last 30 years helping others recover from trauma, chronic pain, and anxiety. She has also written three books. As well as coaching and mentoring people all over the world, she offers a transformational program helping people with chronic pain. Today, she shares her journey. Welcome, dear Hannah.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. And as I said to you, I am delighted especially to meet you, but also that you're all that way in that wonderful place, Jerusalem.
You know, I was thinking the other day, you know, Jerusalem and maybe Las Vegas are places where you don't expect people to live, but we do live here. People do live in Jerusalem and Las Vegas, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those sort of, I don't know, mythical places somewhat, yeah, in that it exists somewhere, whether it be in the imagination or not, but one of those sort of unreachable places only achieved to be reached by the very rare and privileged, I think.
Yeah. But we go to the supermarket and we go to school and we do all the things that other people do as well.
When I was young, Hannah, I always thought of Jerusalem as a place where it only sort of very holy things happened and very holy people lived. And it was somewhere, as you said, far, far away that I don't know whether anyone ever reached, but it was always spoken about. So, but in any case, I'm delighted that you're here. So welcome to you.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Ah, and how are you? How are you today?
I'm doing great. I mean, it's the evening here for me now. So I've had a wonderful day, and this is a really nice way to wrap it up. Yeah, chatting with you.
Now, you have got an awful lot of amazing stories, and you have done a whole load of interesting things. There's so much to it. And I'll say to the audience out there, Hannah has done so many remarkable things, lived a remarkable life, survived an absolutely horrendous 3 attacks on her life. And here she is today, brave and wonderful, and going to share with her amazing story. Tell us a little bit, Hannah. Let's go back to the beginning. Tell us a little bit about your life and how this whole journey of yours from Hollywood to your attacks to where you are now. How did all of this begin?
Well, I grew up in England, and I went to Manchester University. I think that's really where it started. And it was the 80s. I was a punk rocker, you know, dreadlocks. I was very cool. And I was actually in a punk rock band. That doesn't usually get into my resume. But and it was all about the music and, you know, bands and going to gigs. And my first attack happened in a nightclub in Manchester. And a kid wanted to dance with me. I pushed him away. He smashed my head into a concrete pillar on the side of the dance floor and fractured my skull. And I kind of bounced back from that one, literally. You know, I lost my eyesight for a day and missed, you know, school for a week. But I was like, I was young and I was drunk and it was just like, you know, get on with it. My handwriting has never been the same since. I had I've had dizzy spells on and off as a result of the head injury for many years, and then about 3 years later, I was mugged again by 3 men. I was just walking at 6 o'clock in the evening near where I'd been living for a few years, and they just came out of the dark, jumped me, slammed me on the ground, beat me. Like, I thought I was going to die. I can remember hearing my voice screaming. I could feel my like lungs running out of air and thinking, if I can't catch another breath, I'm going to die. If they have a knife, I'm going to die. They were like pulverizing me. I think they were looking for money, which I didn't have. And then they ran off and left me, you know, on a piece of waste ground. And then the third time was down in London, where I was just riding my bicycle home. I'd started working in the theater at this point. And a young kid threw a bike at my head as I was riding home fast and stole my bike from underneath me. And he actually broke my neck. I didn't know it at the time, but he'd cracked the C2 and C3, which are the vertebrae just below your skull. I mean, thank God it wasn't the spinal cord. But I mean, that was bruised quite badly because I couldn't move my head or support my head for quite a while. But, you know, I did recover physically from that stuff. But as you can probably imagine, after the first time, I kind of picked myself up. After the second time, I think PTSD had only just been recognized as a diagnosis at the time. And then by the third time, I went down pretty fast. I couldn't, I was scared to leave the house. I wasn't eating, I wasn't sleeping. You know, it was pretty bad until I finally asked for help. I finally reached out. Yes. Amazing women at a crisis center reached out and helped me and kind of got me to see that I, you know, I wasn't my story and I wasn't what happened to me, and helped me to get back on my feet and on my road to recovery. Yeah.
And this in itself, you know, people talk about post-traumatic stress, mm-hmm. and the effects that can happen immediately. But it's something that I have read about and met quite a number of people, that it's something also that affects you through your life. And this is what I found with a lot of people. Now, I want to ask you about this, actually, because you're the expert on this. But it's something that can strike at any time. So maybe an event happened even 20 years ago, but it can show itself in the mind and body many, many years later. Is that correct?
Yes, it can, but it doesn't have to. I think that's where I could probably part company with a lot of people who are in the trauma world, is that there's often a message that you're broken and you need fixing and you're going to have to cope with this for the rest of your life. You know, and I've worked with people who have been having flashbacks for, you know, over a decade, let's say. Mm. And for sure, it does do something to the nervous system. I can tell you for probably 10 years after my experiences, the sound of footsteps, for example, you know, when those three guys came and you know, jumped me, what I remember about it, the first thing I remember about it is the sound of the footsteps coming up fast behind me. And for years afterwards, you know, I could be on the beach in California, just walking on the boardwalk, you know, with my friends on a beautiful sunny day. And if someone, let's say they were jogging past me, or it was a kid running for a bus, my nervous system would jump, you know, even though I knew I was safe, there was something built into my nervous system that was very jumpy for a very long time. And one of the common symptoms of PTSD is hypervigilance. You know, people who've gone through something like that can have an association with a certain sound or a certain smell, even maybe a place or a person. And when that, you know, situation or person or smell like comes into our consciousness, you can be very, it can be quite disturbing if you don't understand what's happening. And because I didn't understand what was happening, it affected me for at least 10 years, if not a little bit longer. And then when I started understanding how the nervous system works, I realized that it's actually just part of my story. Like, I had this experience about a year or so ago, living here in Israel. I was walking in a park close to my house. And I was just, you know, walking along, people, you know, walking their dogs and out, you know, in the morning having some exercise. And these two men came up behind me jogging and they were chatting and they continued their conversation by going around me. And I haven't had any flashbacks or anything bad happen in probably 10 years. But all of a sudden I went, you know, and immediately I started thinking, I shouldn't be having this reaction. It's been 30 years. You know, I'm a coach, I'm a trauma counselor, right? Can you hear my thinking speeded up? And then I suddenly caught myself. And I suddenly had this insight. Now, if I were walking in a park in Israel and I had, for example, I heard a Manchester accent, I'd also look around because that's also part of my history, right? We all have parts of our history, parts of our like chapters that have happened to us. And in that moment, I saw that what happened to me with those muggings was, I mean, I knew it was in the past, but it's just, it got filed somewhere almost. And I haven't had anything like that since. Insight is so powerful when it shifted my thinking or my perception about it. And it's not good or bad. It just happened. And today I'm safe and I'm free of it. And I have been for a long time. And it doesn't have to rule my life. And I'm not a victim of it anymore. And that's really is freedom, when you understand how experience is created. And I know that today, right here, right now, I'm not broken and I don't need fixing.
That's an incredible power to have, I think, in that. And an incredible, as you said, freedom to be free, in a way, to be free of that experience. And yet that experience remains part of you. Mm-hmm. So to be able to gain that distance between the two is something that is not easily done. Because somehow we, in a way, we become our experiences. And we think that that's all there is. The hurt, the pain, the trauma, it is who we are. But when we heal on many levels, we are no longer the same people, are we?
Yeah, I mean, when those women helped me right back at the beginning, I remember one of the very first things one of them asked me, she said, "Are you ready to let go of your story?" And when I heard her, like what I heard her say was, it didn't happen, or it didn't hurt, or get over it. That's what I felt like she was saying. And in my head, I remember screaming at her going, it did happen, it did hurt, and I can't get over it. Because I'd been telling the story about what happened over and over again, not just to people who would listen, but in my own head. I was reliving it and relive it, which is another kind of major feature of PTSD. You keep reliving and reliving the event. And so it kind of become part of my identity. So when she asked me if I was ready to let go of that story, it was quite threatening at first. Because who am I? I mean, I'd become the girl who was mugged 3 times, you know? It was like, that become part of my identity. It was what, you know, if I did get out the house, it was what I would talk to you about, you know, like, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I can wear earrings again now because my ears are like, I've kind of got over the, you know, my ears got mashed up pretty badly when they attacked me. So now I can wear earrings and I could get any conversation back around to me, you know, my troubles. And so if I was to let go of that, then who am I? Am I boring without those stories? Like, am I interested? Would you be interested in me if I don't talk about my trauma, my dramas, and my problems? And it was quite a journey for me to come out of that and see that I have value and I can be interesting. I can, you know, I've had a fascinating life since then. You know, and I thought my life was over at that point if I let go of the you know, I mean, how. I'm thinking about it now, like how sad. I was 20, you know, 23, 24, thinking if I let go of my trauma, then my life is over and boring. And little did I know, you know, because as I let go of it and my world started to open up again, and at first it was just even getting on a bus or the tube was like, you know, in London, it was very, very nervous just getting out the house because I knew that the world was a scary place. I had police reports and x-rays to prove it. So just getting out the house at first was a major achievement, to then a few years later be getting on an airplane to go to California to work on the first movie I did, you know, was, I mean, my world just opened up the moment I started seeing through the fact that it was a story that I was carrying around. It wasn't what had happened to me. You know, I'm not in denial about it. It happened. It was horrible. Terrifying, in fact, but it's in the past. And from a better state of mind, I can still look at the past. I can tell you the story, and I can do it with understanding and compassion now. Whereas before, it was miserable and disaster and like, you know, forget it. What happened to Hannah? Oh, she's disappeared again. You know, it was just too much to cope with. And now it's just part of my history and it hasn't stopped me doing anything for many, many years now.
It's a fascinating story, I have to say, an incredible one, mm-hmm. Hannah, because as you were talking, I was thinking to myself, we all go through things, and some of us go through really traumatic things. I think that's part of, you know, life, of humanity. Mm-hmm. But my question is, when this happened to you, you were, in a way, how I look at this sort of thing is, you were one person. Then this experience, these experiences, these traumatic experiences happened to you. And in effect, it changed who you were. And then you came, as you said, out of that story. Now, in a way, it's like 3 chapters of a life of that, you know, particular book. When you came out of that trauma, were you the same as before it all happened? Did you regain something of that, I suppose, life of who you were? Or was this something, a completely, you know, like a caterpillar emerging into a butterfly, were you a completely different person?
That's a great question. I think the caterpillar thing is a good analogy, and I love analogies. I love metaphors, because when you said caterpillar, the word metaphor, I can't even say that word. Metaphors, you know what I'm saying.
I know what you mean.
I can't say it.
Let you say it though.
It's late. So I morphed. It's an easier way to say it. Like, yeah. There's been lots of morphing going on. But I say the most recent chapter, if you like, in the most recent chapter, and I don't think it's got anything to do with age. It just happened to be when I came across this, like a new paradigm in psychology that is what I really base my work on now, is that no matter what chapter I was in, whether it was, you know, childhood, you know, the trauma years, the, you know, Hollywood years, you know, the traveling and moving different places, they are all different realities that were created by the thoughts I was having in that moment. The real me, which is what the metaphor, I can't say that word, the real me that was underneath all those stories has always been the same, that I would call innate well-being, that innate wellness, was always there. We're born with it. It's like your default factory setting, if you like. We are born with this innate well-being and wisdom and courage. We are resilience. I mean, resilience is something who human beings are. I mean, just look at, you know, any PTSD story. It's amazing what, you know, human beings can go through and survive. And that is always there. It's a constant. It's a reliable system. And the only time I wasn't in touch with that is because I'd gotten up in my head or up in those stories and believing that's who I was. And that was taking me away from the true person I am. So I feel now that I've kind of come full circle, if it were. I am more, I think I used to be childish. Now I got more childlike. There's a big difference. And because when I was caught up in all that stuff, and not even just the trauma, but like being in Hollywood and, you know, my career and like, you know, you're as good as your last job. And it was all about who you knew and what car you drive and all that stuff. All that was taking me away. It actually was very serious. Though I laughed and, you know, I'd have a good time with friends and stuff, but I've become much lighter, you know, like holding all that stuff lightly. Little kids are brilliant at it. You know, they can just, they're in the moment, they're running around, they're being goofy. And as a young adult and in my 20s and 30s, it was like, I forgot how to be like that. Maybe because of the trauma, probably had a big part of that. But I think whether the trauma had happened or not, I was already getting too much up into my head and too much, you know, overthinking and kind of missing out on beautiful moments. Whereas now I can, you know, I take my thinking a lot less seriously these days, and it makes for a lot, a much lighter feeling, much lighter, you know, life is a lot lighter these days. It was so heavy before. And I think the difference is seeing how we're always feeling our thinking. You know, as much as I thought my circumstances were creating my experience, I see now that I was feeling my thinking about my circumstances. And that's good news, because if I'm the one doing the thinking, then I'm not a victim of my circumstances anymore, no matter what is happening. You are off the hook for how I feel. Whereas before, I thought it was all, I don't mean you, you know, Mimi's fault, but, you know, like, you know, whoever I was with or near, or, you know, whether it's politics and or the weather, you name it, that's why, you know, I felt I was miserable or whatever. And now it's like, you know, I'm only ever feeling my own power. No one can get inside my head except me. And that's really where the freedom comes.
It's amazing, really, because when you talk about this lightness of being, I suppose, and that fundamentally we are always the essence of who we are, regardless of what happens to us.
Yeah.
And that's such an important thing that you have stated there, Hannah, because a lot of us, you know, I suppose so many people out there feel that we become our story, but it's just one of many stories. And I suppose where the trauma lies therein is that if we get stuck in that story and we can't get out of the story, and that's the important thing, is How did you get out of it? How did you manage to become free of it?
I mean, looking back, I guess it was, you know, over several years of trying different modalities and techniques. I did a lot of meditation. I did a lot of writing. I did a lot of, you know, yoga. You know, when you live in Southern California, you know, that stuff's all around you all the time. At least it was back then. But it was an innocent misunderstanding that I thought I needed to do all those things in order to fix myself, or at least change myself, or at least make myself more likable or more successful or more content or something. You know, something's going to fix it. And I knew it wasn't outside stuff like the cars and the career and all that kind of thing. I knew it was like they say, an inside job, but I still felt like I needed to fix that inside, you know, my better thinking, or, you know, better self-esteem or something. In fact, my first book is called The Myth of Low Self-Esteem. Because when I lived in LA, I remember meeting so many people who would talk about their low self-esteem, and yet they were doing it into a microphone in front of 100 people. You know, it's like, I'm like, excuse me, that is not low self-esteem. That's like chutzpah. You know, that's, you know, low self-esteem. I'm not saying there isn't such a thing as low self-esteem. You know, some of us think, you know, really do not think well about ourselves. But it all comes down, excuse me, it all comes down to the thinking. So all those things I was trying, you know, the latest guru, the, you know, the silent retreats in Santa Barbara, the, you know, going to lectures. I used to go to Marianne Williamson, you know, lectures. I don't know if you know that name, but you know,
yes, I do. Yeah, yeah.
Right. So she used to do a monthly lecture in LA because she lived there, and I would always go and hear her speak, and, you know, and then go to the Self-Realization Temple, and, you know, searching. It was like searching was held up as a very admirable quality. And I see now that I wasn't actually very good at it, because it took me 30 years and I didn't really find what I was looking for, because I was looking in the wrong direction. I was looking out there. Even on the spiritual quest, I was looking for something to make me feel better. Maybe it was meditation. Maybe it was, you know, being close to a guru or something. And what I've seen in the last few years is that things like trauma, like, you know, family history, even our careers and, you know, all those kind of things, that's not who we are. Like you said, we're not our stories. And so getting out of it wasn't actually as difficult or as complicated as I'd kind of made it. It doesn't actually have to take a long time. I've actually had clients where I work with now who have seen that they were torturing themselves with their own thinking and pop out of it in just a few minutes. When you see that you just, when you see that you're feeling, you're thinking about the past, and it could be about the future too. Like, you know, a lot of people I work with have things like health anxiety, or, you know, all kinds of anxieties about what if about the future. It doesn't matter if the content of our thinking is about the past or about the future. We're thinking it right here, right now. And that's what we're experiencing. So the quality of our thinking is often reflected in our moods. And my moods go up and down like anybody's does. And that's when you understand how that works, and how if I think about, you know, the trauma and the violence, what happened to me when I'm in a low mood, I'm going to feel awful. You know, I'm going to be miserable. And I used to think about it in a low mood all the time, all day long. And consequently, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, and I was a mess. But what I see now is the low mood was just a consequence of the quality of my thinking. They're very connected, thought and moods. But because if you think about it, if you have low, miserable thinking all the time, you're going to feel low and miserable, right? If you're having happy, abundant, joyful thinking, you cannot be in a low mood. So as my thinking kind of improved, the quality of my thinking improved, and I don't mean positive thinking, I mean just stepping out of the negative stuff, that innate resilience and courage and wisdom just automatically comes in and fills us full of peace and confidence. You didn't have to create it. Like I said, it's who we really are. It's right there waiting the moment we step out of the negative thinking. And from a better state of mind, I can think about the past. And like I said, I can think about it with understanding and compassion even now. Nothing changed in the past, just my perception of it. And that's the beautiful thing, that thought is always moving. It's continuously moving through our minds. And if I can step back and observe it, I don't have to be a victim of it. And that is a reliable system. It's how we're all made. It's not just me. We're all made that same way. We all have this innate resilience and well-being that is there all the time to draw on. And so, like you said, no matter what has happened to us in the past or what we're worried about the future, right here, right now, I'm totally fine. We're safe, and you know, and contentment is really, really the best kind of recipe for mental health.
It's a difficult one, especially I think as time moves on, especially in these times, to remain hopeful. And not only to remain hopeful, but to be able to, I suppose, put the story on the shelf, in a way, of things that have happened to us. How is it possible that you went through so many life-changing things, Hannah, and then went to have a career in Hollywood, became a trauma coach and counsellor? How did you find that courage? Where did that come from?
Well, I remember being asked that question, when was it? A couple of years ago. Anyway, I told my story maybe three times in 1 week. I'd done some, you know, live events here where I live. And each time someone came up to me and said, like, where did you find the courage to, you know, get over the traumas? Where did you find the courage to change careers? Because I just left my Hollywood career one day. I knew it was, well, it wasn't one day. It took a couple of years, but one day that was it. You know, I'd done with it. Where did I find the courage to change, to move countries? You know, I've lived on three different continents. And I thought, okay, let's reflect on this for a moment. Courage is innate. Courage is who we are when our thinking slows down. And I thought, yeah, maybe. And then I realized courage is when the debate stops. Like when you know what the right thing to do is, it's like that's when the debate stops. Like when I decided to move here, for example, and to leave my career in LA, I was a school teacher for 5 years after my Hollywood career. And once I knew it was the right thing to do, the debate stopped. Now, obviously, there's, you know, got to make decisions, and there's still things to be worked out. But the anxiety of the debate stops. And courage is like a lack of anxiety. And anxiety is really just speeded up thinking. And the analogy I like for that is, remember, I don't know how old you are, but when I was a kid and I went to the movies, it was actual film, you know, like they had projectors in movie theaters, you know, back in the day.
Oh, yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Right, because now it's all digital, right? But back in the day when they actually had film that they put into the movie projector, film is made up of a series of still pictures, like they call them frames, right? They're a continuation of lots and lots of still pictures. In fact, that's why they call them moving pictures, because, you know, when you put them in the projector and it speeds up, it creates a image that's moving. So this is very much like how thought works. When thought is going fast, like the film in the projector, it's very hard to see the individual thoughts. It's just zooming along, and the more it speeds up, and then your nervous system kind of gets the feeling that, you know, there's something going on, right? And that, yeah, that can look like it's very hard to get out of, but it's an illusion. It's just speeded up thinking. When you understand how it works, and you start to step out of it, and you see that it can slow down, and then you start to see the individual frames, the individual pictures, the individual thoughts. They're not as toxic as we like to think they are. They're, in fact, all thought is neutral until we have a reaction to it. So as our thinking slows down, there starts to be space in between the thoughts. And this is peace of mind. This is where courage and resilience live, in those spaces in between the thoughts, which is why a lot of the time when I'm talking to people, I'm like, slow down, breathe, please breathe with me. You know, when someone's, when someone's in a panic attack, for example, you know, forget spirituality and resilience and all that, those kind of conversations. You need to get them to breathe, because if they're not getting enough oxygen to their brain, then they're not going to think clearly. And we need to get people to think more clearly. And the as you slow down, then your common sense, your wisdom is going to kick in, because it was always there. It just got covered up. And so we don't have to go find courage. It's not like courage belongs to certain people. It's our birthright. It's who we are. In a better state of mind, we are courage. We are resilience. We are forgiveness. We are gratitude. We don't have to work at it. It's who we really are. That is the gift of being a human being. Only when you don't understand that, or you forget that, or you get speeded up by, you know, it seems by, you know, life circumstances, we can forget that. And that's why, you know, we often need to turn, like I turned to, you know, lots of unhealthy things when I didn't understand what was happening. And now, now I know I just don't need to. I just need to slow down. It's, you know, there's amazing ways that our mind and body are built with such wisdom that let us know when we're off. Excuse me. And if I learn to understand that, like one of the, I made a little meme a while ago, and it said, if you can hear your body whisper, you won't have to listen to it scream.
Oh, I mean, that's excellent.
Right?
Meaning, yeah.
I mean, I think that's why I was in chronic pain for so many years, is because I didn't understand that my thinking was speeded up and I was full of anxiety and my nervous system thought I was in danger on a daily basis. And so it created pain in order to kind of slow me down. Only I didn't understand that's what was happening. So now, so in those times, I was having to listen to it scream. You know, I was paralyzed several times and rushed to the hospital coming off of movie sets. And now I can hear it whisper. You know, I can get an odd ache, you know, or, you know, a virus or something like anybody else. But now when I hear my body whispering to me, slow down, careful, you're getting caught up, then it doesn't have to turn into a major pain flare up or a major, you know, stomach problem or any of those things that I used to have. And consequently, life is much, much more peaceful these days.
Incredible. And it reminds me of a story, actually, Hannah, of when I've spoken about this before, but when I was very young, I had an instance in my life where I woke up one morning and then I couldn't walk for a year. And I remember the orthopedic surgeon saying to me that you have to make pain your friend. And I was at that time devastated. You know, how can I make pain my friend? What does that mean? And he said, well, when you overdo something, the pain's going to get pretty bad. So it's there to remind you. Mm-hmm. To take it easy. And your whisper story is fantastic, because it resonated somewhere inside of me. That same message is that, yes, I always liken it to our soul, where if you don't listen to what it's trying to tell you, it's going to find a whole lot of ways to slap you, and pain being one of them. Because I always used to wonder as a child, where does pain come from? Is it a land that it comes from and comes to teach us a lesson? What is it actually? How does it disappear? And by listening to you actually talking now, it reminds me that they are in fact messengers. Pains in our life are messengers somehow that are there to shake us up and to bring that equilibrium back into our lives. But that's the fine line of how can you, I suppose, elevate yourself from that situation in that moment where all the thoughts are going round and round and where you're feeling afraid and when you're feeling anxious and you don't know what to do. What do you do in that moment? In that moment of, I suppose, fear, a paralysis of fear. How do you get out of that?
I think when you're in the kind of paralysis, you know, panic situation, what I usually say to people is, in that moment, be nice to yourself. You know, it's probably in those few moments, breathing is probably the best thing to do.
Yeah.
There's, you know, like if you have if someone surprises you, you kind of go, right? An in-breath lets the nervous system know that there's danger. Because when, you know, when we have a shock, you go, right? Or if it's a scary movie you're watching, you go, that sharp intake of breath is a signal for the brain that there's something wrong. Now, think about when you've had a big meal, you know, and you go, right? You slump on the sofa and just go, oh, right? Thank God I'm home. Thank God I've, you know, I had this lovely time with my friends. So an out-breath actually calms the nervous system and lets the brain know that you're safe. So that's why in trauma counseling, you know, I'm a trained first responder. And one of the things we're taught is, you know, in the situation where someone's in a panic attack or catatonic even, you know, you want to get them breathing out more than they're actually breathing in. It's that, you know, you can count numbers, but the out-breath has to be longer in order to calm the nervous system. So that's, you know, like a triage, you know, emergency kind of situation, is just get them to breathe and slow down. But in my work, what I really want to do is help people not to get into that emergency room kind of situation, whether it's physical or emotional. So when you understand how, and I loved what you were saying about signals, the body and the mind are full of so much wisdom, and they do give us signals. Like I was working with a 12-year-old kid the other day, and I was trying to get him, you know, the school are saying he has ADHD and they want to medicate him. Like, since when does schools become, you know, doctors? But anyway, don't get me started on that.
Another story for another day.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. So his parents were getting me to work with him so that he didn't need to be in that situation. So I was talking, I wanted to get him to see how feeling annoyed and feeling frustrated has a feeling. So I asked him, you know, what does it feel like when you're hungry? We talked about rumbly tummies. Great. What does it feel like when you're playing football and you get hot and you get, like, I was trying to get him to say sweaty, and he said raining, because it was raining outside. I said my body is raining. I'm like, yeah, that's a really cool way to say it. Yes, your body is raining. Right. And so cute. And then I said, and what about when you're tired? What does it feel like when you're tired? And we talked about how our eyelids get heavy. So if your tummy is rumbling, it doesn't mean you're sick or you're ill or you're dying. It just means you need to eat lunch, right? There's a logic to this way our bodies talk to us. You know, if your eyelids are heavy, it doesn't mean you need surgery. It just means you need to go to sleep, right? So I asked him, what does it feel like when you get anxious or when you get frustrated? And like a lot of people, he kind of pointed at his chest and his throat. I used to get it in my neck. You know, my neck muscles used to get really tight, and my shoulders were always, always tight. You know, like these horrible, horrible pains in my shoulders and neck, because I was permanently anxious and frustrated and annoyed. And so I was saying to him, you know, what if you knew that that tightness in your throat and in your chest means that you've gotten a little bit frustrated or a bit annoyed with someone? And that's your signal to slow down. See, when I used to feel like that, when I could feel my heart beating faster or my neck muscles getting tighter, I kind of took that as an invitation to go further into it, right? You know, I would get more anxious and more, you know, angry. These days, a lot of my clients are Googling at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, on WebMD and scaring themselves silly. And
Google like, doctor.
Right, yes. Right. Okay. So this guy in Singapore said, you know, like, oh my gosh, I'm dying. Right. So, you know, I can't tell you how many people just scare themselves, you know, by Googling things. And I know now that if I get to the point where I need to Google something, like, I've gone way past common sense, you know. I'm not saying you should never Google something, but like I was saying before, if you're Googling something in a low mood, you know, especially if you're doing it at 2 or 3 in the morning, probably not a good idea. You're only going to scare yourself more. What if you knew that feeling of, you know, for some people, they feel anxiety in their stomach or their gut. Some people feel it in their arm and leg muscles. You know, some of us feel it in our neck. Or even in your face, whatever it is for you, what if you knew that that was a signal to stop? What if it was a signal that you were heading into some unuseful thinking that was only going to make you more scared and more anxious? And there is no good information in that low mood. Low moods never end well, so stop, right? I innocently didn't know this before, and so I couldn't hear that whisper, and I had to listen to my body screaming. So now I know that several ways not to go into that, I watch, like, if I can feel it physically in my body, sometimes I miss that and I'll hear it in my thinking. My thinking starts going, nobody understands and it never works out. And it always turns out, you know, that kind of very black and white thinking. That's, that's another clue I've kind of gone in the wrong direction. And when it speeds up, when it gets faster, and if you put all that together, my shoulders are tight, my thinking speeded up, and it's very negative. Oh my gosh. And I have actually popped out of that at times. It's quite amazing when you suddenly realize you were just caught up in your thinking and you're actually okay in this moment. I've actually started laughing. You know, sometimes it takes more, like, you know, you wake up in the morning and you feel better, but I've actually literally popped out of it sometimes and realized, oh my gosh, I just started torturing myself with my own thinking. Snap out of it. And then you can see the sun is shining. I'm home and I'm safe. There's actually nothing to worry about in this moment. And I've got everything I need. And it's just awareness. It really is just awareness. So I love what you were saying about signals. And another one for me is sarcasm. If I start getting sarcastic or a bit snippy or a bit impatient, that's another signal that I'm not in my best mind. So therefore, shut up. I've learned not to have anything on it now, because then you could just judge yourself. Oh, I shouldn't have got up and, like, you know, like, my teacher said I shouldn't be doing this. I read that book and it said I see all those shoulds. That's judgment, and I've gotten, that's just more low thinking. If you had nothing on it at all. So to go back to the pain question, if I'm in a pain flare up, what if you had nothing on it? What if we didn't overreact or have any reaction? The nervous system's going to calm down and the pain can go away. It doesn't have to last for hours and weeks like it used to before. It's having nothing on it, meaning no reaction, no judgment of it, of yourself, of the pain, of your body, then you're going to be in a much, much healthier place to hold it lightly. And things can come and go, and it's not such a big deal. And then in that frame of mind, you can make some really great judgments and decisions about your health, about your relationships, from a place of wisdom, as opposed to a place of desperation. And it just makes living life so much easier.
I love that. Yes, a place of wisdom as opposed to a place of desperation. And this awareness, as you speak about, Hannah, is wonderful, because, you know, there are days when you really have to be aware, I think, consistently aware of the moment. And for myself, I catch myself, like you were talking about, in that I say, I don't want to be friendly. And when I know I don't want to be friendly, that means I'm in a bad mood. So there's no point in making any decisions about anything. You know, don't even make a decision about whether to have this for dinner or that for dinner. Because becoming aware of that and then dissolving that mood and learning how to dissolve it. And I had this sort of internal sort of conversation with myself. Well, I'm in a bad mood. I don't want to talk to anyone. And then I say, well, what's going to get me in a better mood? And I offer myself a solution so that I am gentle again with myself. And I think that's really important, is that we forget, don't we, so many times, to be gentle and to be kind to ourselves mm-hmm. in these moments of frustration, of pain, of, I suppose, remembrance of things that have gone on a long time ago. And it's important to bring ourselves back to the moment, like you say, and just be kind.
Yeah, one of the analogies I like to use for moods is a lift or an elevator for our American friends, right? Where as an elevator goes up and down, and the book that I just wrote that just came out, I use the example, the main character, my books are novels. I like to write stories about these things because I find that's much more engaging way to get people's attention, and I sneak in some information into the story.
Uh-huh.
And the main character in my new book, she works in a department store in Los Angeles. And so the idea of an elevator going up and down to different floors, I found is a very useful analogy for moods. You know, when we're in a low mood, like say you're in the basement, then you're probably not going to be kind to yourself, because in the basement, it's dark, it's confined, it's dirty. You know, there's lots of rubbish or garbage down there, and it's not a pleasant place to be. And so when we're in not a pleasant place, we kind of tend to get very negative and very, there are multiple ways that people act out when we're in a low mood. Some people get very down on themselves and very, blaming themselves and very self-critical. Other people get very blamey and critical of other people. Some people eat too much. Some people don't eat enough. Some people are getting very controlling and loud, and other people get very quiet and passive. When we're in a low mood, there's all kinds of a whole spectrum of behaviors and characteristics that show up. And we all know what our personal favorites are, right? That story about your mother comes up. You know, everybody has those core, few insecure stories that show up when we're in a low mood. And then as moods go up, like as an elevator goes up through, like say a department store, as you go up through, there's usually housewares is usually the next one up. And it's, it's still kind of a low ceiling, lots of products packed in there. But it's a bit, there's a bit more light there. And then you get up to cosmetics and ladies' shoes, the ground level where it's much, there's pretty smells and, it's a bit lighter. And then as you go up and up, ladies wear, men's wear, you kind of get a better perspective. And so on the roof, let's say, of a department store, you might have an amazing view. You can see all the way out to the ocean or out to the mountains or out to the park. And you can like feel the fresh air and you can see further. You know, that's why I love this analogy for moods, is because when I'm in a better mood, I see possibilities. I'm open to new ideas. I'm flexible. I'm creative, because there's a freshness there. But as you go down in our state of mind, in our moods, and one of the things I learned about pain is we only experience pain when it comes into consciousness. So for example, if you're in a low mood and you stub your toe or you're having a surgery, you're going to feel the pain of that in a much more intense level in a low mood than if you're in a better mood. And there's lots of science and research to back this up. If you're in a better mood, you're going to recover from a surgery or a broken heart or, all the kinds of things that just happen to us in life. We're going to be much more equipped and better able to handle life stuff when we're in a better, lighter mood. When we're in a low mood, I have no coping skills. I have to write gratitude lists. I have to work on being forgiving, right? Because I've kind of lost touch with who I really am. And when you understand this is just a question of moods going up and down, and everybody's moods go up and down, it's natural and it's normal. As I learned to not be frightened by this, that I could even be in a lower mood now, which, you know, thank God I don't visit the basement hardly ever anymore. But if I can feel myself heading in that direction, so what? It's not a big deal. You know, it's not going to last. It's thought is always moving. It's going to move on. The mood will pass because they always do. And so the less reactive and the lighter I hold that, it's going to move through so much quicker and easier. And then we bounce back to our, because remember, we are resilience. You don't have to go work on resilience. We are resilience. And you bounce back. And, you know, that's why we often feel better the next day. Like, oh, thank God. And you're so right about not making decisions when you're in that low mood, you know, no matter what it's about. I've learned that, you know, if my thinking speeds up, this is not a good time to make a decision. This is not a good time to think about, you know, a business idea or a relationship issue when I'm in a low mood. It's going to pass. And whether that's in 5 minutes or 5 hours, I don't know. But I have absolute faith that it will pass. I know that it will pass. I know my innate well-being will be there when I kind of pop out of it, when I let go of the old, you know, the old ideas and the stinky thinking. And you're right back to your well-being. It really is a reliable system. And I think that's why my pain went away. That's why my anxiety went away. Because I started understanding how it works. And when you understand how something works, it takes away a lot of the fear and anxiety of life. You know, so it's a much, much easier way to live.
And it's also, I suppose, about getting to know oneself better in order to stave off these feelings of anxiousness and the 3 o'clock in the morning where every single person that has ever upset you or you feel wronged by and it comes to visit you, you know, that feeling, Hannah. And no, I'm not going to make a decision at 3 o'clock in the morning because you know it's not a good time to do that. Right. And let's wait till the morning when, you know, when dawn has appeared. And then everything is fine again. And it's true. It's something that is innate in us. This, we have this tremendous strength as human beings, and the human spirit is something that's really magnificent in so many ways. And it's a wonderful reminder to have you here today in... actually a reminder for myself firstly and for all the people out there is that actually we are far more stronger and braver than we actually realize.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's what is so wonderful. And you know, really thank you for this timely reminder as well, because it's something that we all need to hear and to practice, even if it's a small step in the being present and aware of ourselves. That is so important, because so many things out there are dragging us and in one direction, in another direction, and people as well. I think it's important. I wanted to ask you about being with people that, I suppose, give you that space to allow you to be aware of who you are, as opposed to suppressing who you are.
Although I used to think that how I felt, like whether you felt suppressed or you know, celebrated or whatever, I used to think that that was coming from other people, that you know, he makes me feel better and she really annoys me and all that kind of stuff. And I started to see that that actually isn't true, that nobody can make you feel anything. I mean, think about a time when you watched a movie with a friend or a family member and one of you is loving it and one of you is hating it. So who's right? Right? So yeah. It can't be the movie that's producing that experience. It's the individuals thinking about the movie that's, you know. So really nothing on the outside of me, including people or the weather or the government or sports or you name it, nothing on the outside of me can actually make me feel anything. Now, are there people I'd rather hang out with? Absolutely. You know, these days, especially because I spend a lot of my day talking to people who are struggling and suffering, you know, my friends are people who are pretty positive, not that they have to be perfect by any means. Nobody's perfect. But I do choose to, when I'm, you know, not working, I'd rather hang out with people who are a bit more positive and, you know, looking in a more healthy direction, for sure. But it's not them that are creating my good feeling. It's my thinking about them or my thinking about the music or the movie or the sports or the walk in the park, whatever it is, that is creating my experience 100% of the time. That no one can get inside our heads except us. And so in that better state of mind, I am going to choose probably a better quality of person to be around, because that's just seems common sense to me. If I'm, you know, spending the rest of my time talking to people who are struggling, it's nice to be with happy people. I used to hate happy people, by the way. when I was in a low mood, I hated happy people. I thought happy people were stupid because they clearly didn't understand, you know, what's going on in the world and what pain I'm in. And can you hear that basement thinking? Oh my gosh, that is, you know, that is one of the ways I used to, I know now that that I'm not in a good place is when I want to blame other people for how I feel. But when you understand that no one can make me actually feel anything, it's always my thinking about them that is creating it. Like I said, it lets you off the hook, and then nobody else is responsible for how I feel. And I can actually be in quite a difficult situation and be okay. It's a very different way of being in the world that
It's a good way to be in the world.
Yeah.
And it's an extremely strong way to be. Mm-hmm. And it's fantastic. We have also on the other side of the coin that there are certain people who love to take us down in the elevator to the bottom floor.
Yeah.
They love it. Mm. And when you have that strength that you speak about, no one can take you anywhere that you don't want to go.
Yeah.
And that's really important to know, I think.
Yeah. And if anybody is listening to what you just said and say, oh no, but you don't understand what it's like for me or my situation, that's just a thought that went through your head. Can you see that? You know, when we think our situation's different, I knew my situation was different. You haven't been through what I've been through, right? Like I used to call it competitive tragedy. You know, you tell me your story. Oh, I would blow your story out of the water with my broken neck story. Yeah. Right? I could trump anybody's story, right?
Yeah.
So I said I could get a gold medal for England in competitive tragedy.
That's such a good word, actually.
Right. See how I can laugh about it now? If we'd had this conversation, you know, back when I was, you know, a few years after I'd been mugged, I'm not talking to you ever again. You are, you know, you clearly don't get it, how miserable life is and how scary the world is. Mm. So if anybody's listening is feeling like, yeah, but my situation's different. You don't understand what I'm going through. You don't understand what I've been through. I'm inviting people to, can you see that was a thought that just went through your mind? It doesn't mean anything about your past. Like I said, I'm not in denial about what happened to me. And I could go into much more graphic detail about it. You know, it was pretty, pretty bad. But it's not happening in this moment. And if I think it is, it's because I think it is. We are, like, life is what we think. It's not what we think about. Life is thinking. We experience our thoughts 100% of the time. And if my thoughts are negative, if they're in the basement, if they're, you know, feel like they're being dragged down, that is me getting sucked into the illusion of that kind of basement type thinking. And if I know that that's what's happening, I don't need any tools and techniques to get out of it. I just need awareness. It's like if you put your hand, you know, in a fire, you don't think, what kind of tool and technique should I use to take my hand out the fire? No, it's like, ouch, right? It's you. That's resilience. That is wisdom, tells you to take your hand out the fire. When you realize you're hurting yourself with some stinky thinking, I just stop now. You know, it's like, well, slow down. You know, I just got caught up, which is okay because I'm human and it can happen. And just knowing that it's going to pass, and all thoughts, all thinking that you've ever had is always moving on. There's no need to reframe or think of positive thinking. I don't need to do writing and meditation anymore, because the moment I realize it, it's like a magic elevator. You kind of automatically pop up like a cork, you know, in water. Its natural property is to pop up. That's what human resilience is. We pop up and you're back to the sunshine. You're back above ground. You're back above, like, oh, thank God.
It's a good analogy, actually. Mm-hmm. It is a very good analogy, in that I suppose the power of who we are is the thing that keeps us afloat.
Yeah.
That keeps us flying high, so to speak.
Yeah.
As opposed to crawling around on the floor with everything that's dark. And the elevator story is the most brilliant story I've heard in a long time, actually. I'm going to be thinking about that. And I remember that at 3 a.m, Hannah. It's just an elevator moment.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those moments. Now, to finish off, tell us about, you have these books which look absolutely fantastic and fascinating. Now, there are 3 books, or are there 4 books?
There are 3 out right now. I'm writing another. I'm in the middle of the 4th one, and I have ideas for 5 and 6 at least.
Okay, great. Now, tell us about the first 3, sort of a little synopsis about each one for people out there that are listening that would like to purchase them.
Sure. So all the books are on Amazon. The first one is called The Myth of Low Self-Esteem, like I mentioned. And that really, it's funny, I thought that was the only book I was going to write, so I just threw all my juicy stories in there. It starts off, the books are novels, because I found that, you know, sometimes if you're tired and you're overwhelmed or you're in pain, to read another textbook or another self-help book might be just too heavy and too much. So I find by writing stories, the characters do the suffering and the struggling and the falling down, and then the, you know, have the insights and the, you know, the surviving and the thriving and the happy ending. So you kind of go along on a journey with these characters. And I kind of, like I said, sneak in some science and some information and good, you know, good stuff in there. So the first one is really about the traumas that happened to me, the violence I went through in my 20s. And then it goes into how I came out of that. I have an alter ego. Her name's Deborah in the books. She's not me, but I use a lot of my own stories to, you know, to make the books juicy. I put in quite a lot of stuff about my Hollywood career. I got to dance with John Travolta and travel around the world with all kinds of famous people, which is amazing. And then about how I came across these ideas that I've been sharing with you, that we are, you know, innate well-being, and that we have resilience, and so that's the first book. The second book is called Painless, because I when I noticed that all my pain had gone away, my 25 years of chronic pain had gone away, and I've been pain-free for about 6 or 7 years now. And when I say pain, that includes IBS and allergies and skin problems and all kinds of things I suffered over, you know, a period of 20, 30 years. Have all gone away. I wrote a novel, and Deborah kind of becomes a pain coach in that book. And she goes to Australia and New York, and she's working with different people. So I kind of called on a lot of the clients I've worked with to use as examples of how no matter what physical chronic situation you're in, it can get better. You know, if you understand, you know, where your experience is coming from, you know, our thinking calms down and you can get better. And then the most recent book, which came out just a month ago, which incidentally got to Amazon number one bestseller. Woohoo!
Just congratulations.
Yeah, in the Freud section, but that's a win. I'll take it. it's called Very Well, a novel about hormones, women, and why Freud was wrong. So that one, Deborah's now become a minor character. I've got other characters coming in. So this one is about a mother who is going into menopause, and she has two daughters, one who's suffering postpartum depression and the other one is suffering a diagnosis called PMDD. PMDD is a very serious version of PMS. It's like PMS on steroids. These women who suffer this are almost suicidal. And so between the three of them, they kind of cover every hormonal distressful situation women can go through. And they also get pointed to this mind-body connection and these ideas. And the mother sets up a hotline, which is kind of another vehicle for having lots of calls coming in of different situations like IVF and endometriosis and many of the situations women find ourselves in, and like postpartum and pregnancy, where hormones appear to be malfunctioning and driving us crazy. And the research I found is that it's often not the hormones. The hormones are quite normal. It's normal to go up and down. And what's happening is we're just having a hyper reaction to it. And that's what's creating the experience. And I actually had some women with menopause and PMDD read the manuscript, and their symptoms started to go away, which is incredible. You know, when you
that's
really
incredible.
Understand. Yeah, it's amazing. When you understand how your body works and how your mind works and how they work together. And there's always a wisdom there in you know, the things that we go through, especially in the hormonal situation, and men have hormones too. It's normal and natural. And when we understand that and we don't react to it, our nervous systems again can calm down and cope so much better. In fact, it's just, I mean, my symptoms went away when I came across these ideas. So yeah, and they all have happy endings. All the books have happy endings.
I love this idea, Hannah, mm-hmm. that it's a story, because
yeah.
storytelling is an art form. And mm-hmm. as you said, you don't want to, when you're in these situations, you don't want to always read about a textbook explanation. You want to relate to a character, somebody mm-hmm. out there who is also going through what you're going through. I think it's a fantastic idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so thank you. So all these books they're on Amazon.
On Amazon. Okay. Yeah. Are they Kindle or print form,
yes.
or both?
Both. Yes. They're both on Kindle. They're all three of them are on Kindle and print paperback. I'm yet to get the audio together, so forgive me for that, but it's on the list of things to do.
Wonderful.
So yes, you can find them on Amazon.
I'm going to get them actually.
Yay.
Because yeah, I definitely will, because they are a very interesting subject. Each one of them has something on there. And, you know, when you read something and it sort of resonates immediately with you and you think, yes, this is absolutely it. So I will get them, and I'm going to let you know how I get on with that.
Yeah, please. I'd love to hear.
Oh, now for people out there, Hannah, who want to get in contact with you and look at all the other things you've done and the work, where can they contact you?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So I have a website. It's my name. Hannah is spelt with a C-H. So it's C-H-A-N-A-S-T-U-D-L-E-Y, hannahstudley.com. You can find me on Facebook. I have two Facebook groups. One is called Stress, Anxiety, and the Three Principles. That's the main one. I've got a smaller one for the hormone groups as well, if any of the women want to join that one. And I'm going to be doing I do book clubs on each of the books. So the new one, Very Well, the hormone one, I'm going to be starting a book club on that, where we're going to go through the book and study, you know, not study, but you know what I mean? Like take a deeper dive into the ideas presented in here. So if you want to hear about any of that, you could find me on Facebook, join my email list, and I'll be sending out information about that very soon.
Very interesting. Send me an invitation.
Yes.
Because it all sounds very fascinating. And I'm interested. I love the covers of your books, but especially the Very Well one. Who is that on the photograph on the cover of the book?
I'm so glad you asked that. Thank you. So the lady, it's a black and white picture for those of you who haven't seen it. It's I actually had to pay for the rights to use that print. Her name is Bertha Pappenheim, and her name has only recently become known publicly. She's been known for a good, maybe 100 years by a pseudonym, which was Anna O. And any of our Freud experts out there will recognize that name. Anna O was one of Freud's first clients. She's actually the one who called psychoanalysis the talking cure. She was the daughter of a wealthy family in Germany, and she was very, very ill. And Freud and his partner Breuer tried treating her, and they claimed they had cured her and that psychoanalysis was the cure. But what actually happened was she was abandoned by them, and she ended up in a sanitarium in Switzerland, addicted to morphine and, you know, having electric shock treatment and eels put on her and all kinds of horrible things. But she got herself out. And 2 years after she got out of the hospital, she was writing, publishing children's books. Now, I have self-publishing on Amazon that helps me do it. How on earth she was doing that in 1800 or whatever it was? She then became a social worker. And she spent her life working for women and children. She traveled from Moscow to Jerusalem to New York, campaigning for what they used to call white slavery, which we now call sex trafficking. So she was campaigning on behalf of women who were forced into prostitution, children who were orphaned. She set up homes for these people and found them jobs. And then when the war came in Germany, the Second World War, she took children away from Nazi Germany to Glasgow in England to save them. And when she was in her 70s and dying of gallbladder cancer, she was interrogated by the Gestapo. And then after she died, the Gestapo went into her orphanages and took the children away to Auschwitz. Now, she had this incredible life and worked for other people, and nobody's heard of her. So I kind of fed her story into the modern story in the book. And I just wanted to give her credit because she's the kind of woman that, you know, she's such a role model, and yet nobody's heard of her. So that I'm doing my bit to get Anna was her pseudonym, Bertha Pappenheim's name out there, and to see what an incredible woman she was.
Well, I think you're there, you're getting there, and you've certainly done that, because I wondered, it was such an interesting cover. And I thought, well, this lady must have some sort of meaning, a far greater meaning, to be on the cover of the book in that way. So thank you very much for sharing that. And I'm going to, is there much information about her, Hannah?
I found a biography of hers and she was referred to in a few other books. But yeah, I kind of feed more about her history in and out of the, like, the book is set in contemporary Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. But I feed Bertha's information, and, you know, I kind of made it a project for one of the characters, and that's how you get to hear about what happened to her.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I want to thank you again. It's been a wonderful, wonderful, I can't even really put into words, because it has been such a beautiful talk with so many wonderful reminders and timely reminders about how to remain human in a way, and how to keep that strength and that courage, and to remind us all that our very essence is so very beautiful. And I want to thank you for that, Hannah, because it has been a wonderful evening to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure talking with you too.
Ah, and do come again, because I know what people are going to say to me. Why didn't you ask her more about Hollywood? I know that's going to be. So please do come back again, and we can talk about all your interesting adventures when you were in that interesting land of Hollywood.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you.
Oh, well, I wish you all the very best. And as I said, look after yourself, and I wish you all the most wonderful of moments in life.
Oh, thank you. You too.
Oh, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Hannah Studley, fascinating talk.
Thank you so much for joining me today. And as always, I really appreciate your presence here with my guests and myself. Until next time, look after yourselves. Stay happy, stay lucky, and lots of love.
Thank you for listening to Secrets for an Inspirational Life, brought to you by your host, Mimi Novick. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast and see you in the next episode. For more information about Mimi Novick and her books, music, and inspirational work, take a look at her website, www.miminovick.co.uk.